Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to On the Continent, your one-stop shop for all things European football. I'm Dotton Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
And on today's show, we assess the current situation with Europe's international sides after a load of matches last night. And we also look at continental football's continuing battle with coronavirus after Napoli didn't turn up for their match against Juventus. And how have La Liga's giants ended up so skint? But first, we really ought to talk about the end of the transfer window this week. How was it for you, Miguel?
Relatively busy, but not as busy as expected. And that's, of course, partly because we've had, I'd say, one of the most lopsided windows in memory. And I suppose the easiest indication of that is the fact that the Premier League spent 1.3 billion total, I think it was 900 million or thereabouts net spend, while if you combined every other league in Europe, it's a 2 billion drop. With, I suppose, the biggest illustration of that, the almost complete lack of any sort of compelling signings in, well, at the top two in Spain, which I suppose is reflective of the health of the league and also reflective of the wider situation.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it? And you talked about it in the intro, Dotton, about why are they so skint. I mean, I think you can look at all of Barcelona, Real Madrid and Atletico, because Real Madrid, of course, you've got to start with them, the champions. Don't sign a player in a summer window for the first time since 1980. But that's not even the headline. You know, you look at the fact that Barcelona and Atletico on transfer deadline day, and if you look at Barcelona particularly in better years, they don't like to leave business to the last minute. They habitually do nothing in the winter window because the winter window is the last refuge of scroungers and grifters. Yeah.
Bad planners.
Exactly. Bad planners. But both Barcelona and Atletico, and I think what's going on at Barcelona is actually taking a bit of the heat off Atletico. They're trying to shift salary on the final day of the window so they can get players in. Now, what we've got to clarify here, in case listeners are unaware, is there is a salary cap for each team in Spain. Now, it's not a one-size-fits-all salary cap as you would get in American sport. It's related to your income as a club. But despite the fact that, say, Barcelona had 1 billion euros of revenue last year, they were still struggling to shift people on the final day, not so they could sign Lautaro Martinez, so they could sign Memphis Depay, who is a player in the final year of his contract, who, you know, whether people would say he's a Barcelona player or not, in inverted commas, I think is hardly the point here. The fact that someone that they were going to pay 25 million euros for, and a salary that I'm led to believe he was going to be given a five-year contract that he'd agreed several weeks further back, he would have got paid less in his first year at Barcelona than he was getting paid at Lyon, because he was so desperate to get there.
But and even you talked about whether he's a kind of Barcelona player or not, but even this question, or, you know, the fact they've gone from, reflects something else about Barcelona. In for so long, well, there was always actually issues with transfers when Cheeky Bigurison was there and trying to buy for Guardiola, but it's kind of a separate issue. Mm. But for so long, at least Barcelona would generally sign, as I said, well in advance, and specific types of players that, you know, that suited a certain approach.
Whereas rather than a certain coach.
Yeah. Whereas this feels such a kind of one of those classic circumstantials, almost on the hoof signings, because basically Koeman likes Memphis from working with him with Haaland.
Well, then why not sign him? But it's not just Barcelona there. I've got problems, Miguel. In La Liga, it's also Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid, as was mentioned a little bit earlier, a moment or two ago by Andy. Why have all these three big teams in Spain coalesced in a way to have financial problems or whatever it might be?
Well, I'd say the biggest issue is ultimately there were already financial issues which had to be looked at, and there were, I mean, we've mentioned the salary cap, but I think the wage to turnover ratio for a lot of biggest clubs in Spain was already at a point of concern, with that, with basically COVID coming at precisely the wrong time, and it meant these issues have been
not least if they've got these huge stadiums to bring in income so that they can spend a lot more money.
That's huge, actually, isn't it?
And this is one of the interesting things as well. All this comes at a point when Madrid have been actually pressing ahead with plans to try and renovate the Bernabeu.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Of course, they're still playing at their training ground, for goodness sakes. They're playing La Liga games at their training ground because they're behind closed doors. But the Barcelona thing is extraordinary. I know they're everyone's favourite object of rubbernecking in European football at the moment. But I think if you look at what's happening with them and this effort to try and sort of procure these marginal gains to try and get small signings in the final days of the window, I mean, they almost set their fans up, and not just their fans, but Ronald Koeman more, for disappointment. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure the fans could be any more disappointed than they currently are anyway, but set Ronald Koeman up for disappointment to let him know that he wasn't going to get Memphis over the line in the end. It's the fact that just before the transfer deadline, if you're expecting an announcement from the club, it's a signing announcement, but they're like, yeah, these are our financial results for this year. I mean, when your financial results for the year come out, hours before the transfer window shutting, that's not a good sign, is it?
Can you imagine if you're Messi after that? given everything that prefaced this summer.
Is that where their problem starts from then? Is that where their problem starts from? For on the one hand, you've got a player of his stature who doesn't want to be there, or at least by all accounts doesn't want to be there, and you don't resolve that over the summer. You've still got his wage bill, and you can't bring anybody else in as a result of that.
Well, I mean, without going back into, I suppose, the Messi issue, I mean, it's almost the great, what is becoming the great dilemma of possibly the greatest player of all time, where he has such a gravitational effect on your wage bill. And there is the argument that the longer you have Messi there, the harder it actually is to have the full-scale reboot that Barcelona need, because they need the space from the money. Well, and he occupies a lot of that. But then, of course, there's the question of getting rid of your greatest player. I mean, that's a greater issue as well, of course. But the other thing I can't help thinking of, I mean, for basically the last 12 years, we've, you know, Barca have basically become the biggest, biggest club in the world, and also the highest possible comparison. Like, when we talk about great clubs, we talk about Barcelona, and the Barca identity and DNA has become kind of, you know, something everyone's tried to replicate. But as true as that has been, what has also remained true is what is just as integral to the Barca identity going back decades is that this club is just incapable of escaping crisis. It always comes back. Yeah. They must be, I think more so than any big club, the extremes they go. And even if you go back to like the 70s or the 50s when they had like their first really great European side under Helenio Herrera, we have 2 years of obviously dominating Spain, saw him leave in controversy as Madrid then totted up a European trophy. So it didn't Cruyff describe it as el entorno, basically. That yeah. It's just this swirl that goes around the club all the time.
And the financial mess is something yeah. that has been there for actually over two decades. Mm. They've kept the wolf from the door
yeah.
at various points. But a lot of the job that previous presidents did, like Joan Laporta, Sandro Rosset, who obviously got himself into legal trouble with what he was doing there. A lot of what happened under the Rijkaard era, for example, which I think most people would think of as the starting point of modern Barcelona. Of course, it's separate from Pep Guardiola Barcelona. But when we think of Barcelona in the modern era having great players that are envied all over the world and playing good football and winning stuff again, you have to go back to that Rijkaard era, don't you? Starting in the mid-noughties. And the fact is that then they were... There's never been a bottomless pit for them
yeah.
because they've always been dealing with these issues. But I guess what would take us on to Atletico Madrid here is all been compounded by just absolutely dreadful business in the transfer market. And you look at, say, if we do flip it to Atletico and them trying to create a space where they could sign Cavani, or create a space on the last day where they could sign off Lucas Torreira on loan, for goodness sakes. I mean, the fact is that we still think of them as underdog Atletico, who probably won the 2014 title in La Liga and probably got to within a whisker of the Champions League trophy in that same year. The wage bill that they're rocking now compared to the wage bill then, oh my God, it's unbelievable. And they're in a similar position to Barcelona in the sense that there are quite a few unshiftables on big wages, and Thomas Lemar being the big one of those, of course.
Although Atletico managed to shift Thomas Partey. I'm not sure if they shifted.
Not on purpose.
Exactly. I was coming on to that as well. So they did some business in any case. They got
yes.
money coming in the other way rather than going out in respect of that. And I wonder whether the window that they've got now to replace him is a window that they really want. They've got a 30-day window, haven't they, to replace him with some suitable local or at least Spanish replacement.
Yeah, that's right. They can buy someone from La Liga, and it looks like a bit of sunshine is going to fall into their lap, because the reports today are that the replacement is going to be Jeffrey Condogbia of Valencia. And of course, Valencia are in another situation, Miguel. I think you would look at this club and say the owner is asset stripping at the moment,
yeah.
because that they are giving away their best players, giving away, the, I guess, their most expensively paid players. It seems like Condogbia has already agreed terms with Atletico. He's not going to cost market value because they yeah, just simply want to get rid of contracts.
Yeah, yeah. And when you're engaged in a fire sale like that, basically you don't set anything at market value. It's a remarkable situation, and quite so. I mean, I was there in November when they played Chelsea, and there was actually a bit of a sense that Valencia might, despite all the ructions, they might be kind of stabilising a bit. And it's just, I suppose this has been reflective of the last few years. Again, what the current situation is doing, a little bit like Barcelona, but more pronounced and to a much more troubling degree, I would say, it's just exposing problems that have been sitting there for about two decades. And with Valencia,
exactly.
of course, it goes back to the move of the stadium, which still hasn't happened.
I mean, basically, it's if you're standing on the edge of a cliff,
yeah.
you're vulnerable to a gust of wind, aren't
yeah,
you? That's basically what it is.
Well, and what was it that Johan Cruyff said? Was it interno?
El entorno, yeah.
What does that mean?
Basically, the storm around the club.
Oh,
the constant.
always referred to.
Which level. He was only partially responsible
yeah,
for.
Yeah, only partially, yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a long time ago.
The cleansing rain.
Got to draw a line underneath that at some point or other. Of these three teams, though, these three big Spanish teams that are struggling in all sorts of ways, off field, as it were, which of them has got the best hope of coming out of it smelling roses, or whatever the Spanish equivalent is?
I think there's there's an issue in that Real Madrid were very, very good, if you go back a couple of years to Ozil and Di Maria, of having players that it was no secret they were trying to shift and were dead weight to them, but managing to shift them for quite a lot of money. That is something that is no longer possible in the current environment. And actually, as Miguel says, it predates COVID. So I think if you look at Isco, for example, it's just been treading water there for a year and a half, and they haven't been able to shift him. Now, that is a problem for Real Madrid. I think Barcelona is maybe even going to get worse before it gets better, even though Bartomeu is facing a vote of no confidence, so he could be gone before March. But I suspect the next board will end up still paying for a lot of his mistakes. So even though Atletico are in this position where they're incredibly reliant on Champions League receipts, if they had even a year outside the Champions League, they'd be in difficulty. Yeah. I have no doubt about that. I feel that Atletico are almost in the strongest, I wouldn't say they're in a strong position, but they're maybe in the strongest position of those three as stand at the moment.
Well, I mean, the hope is, from a wider football perspective, was given Spain has been another major league that has essentially followed the consequences of football's financial disparity, where, okay, it's been lucky enough to have two clubs that can win, and maybe a third rather than just one. But the hope is, maybe these kind of cracks just allow space for someone else to do something different, or potentially an alternative title winner, even if it's not Atletico. Well, Atletico, I mean, it should be one of their chances.
Dotton, he's only gone and thrown Sevilla in there. Have you seen that? He's just thrown Sevilla in there.
And is it Villa or Sevilla? Yeah.
Sevilla.
Well, it's Sevilla to some. Just say that. Sevilla to me, obviously.
Good to clarify.
And they do a nice line in oranges. Let's not forget that. But as we're talking about all of this, and how important was it that Miguel threw Sevilla in there? Out of interest, by the way, before I go on.
If there's a year that they can do it, it's maybe this year, they've got someone who can run a club way better than anyone at either of the big three.
Just in relation to Madrid, though, what is interesting about Madrid is for a few years, they seem to have got their transfer business finally right, and they concentrated on a policy where they were bringing in good players before the age of 23, and it gave and throughout the back end of that period, they won four Champions League titles in 5 years. It suddenly gave them this. They'd obviously had this star first team, but then the rest of the squad was a good block of kind of 7 to 8 out of 10 players who had maybe more potential. But I suppose one of the issues now is that a lot of those players, Isco maybe being the key example, haven't quite kicked on to the level you'd expect to become the really top class stars that Madrid should have. And it's maybe left them with a hangover of a problem in the sense of what you say about selling on these players, or players that are maybe they could discard.
Yeah, and I think that's right. Zidane is facing a completely different job to the job he had the first time, which was more of a sort of Del Bosque style, slightly more sexy than Del Bosque, a sort of caretaker the first time. Whereas the second time, especially, and he kind of should have sowed the seeds for it the first time round, and because they won the Champions League, it wasn't really over-examined. And in fact, the essence of Zidane as a coach is never really examined, because the personality, the aura is so huge. But I think
he got Gareth Bale off his wage bill
at about the 50th attempt. We'll give him that. But I think so much of what his job is now is a developer of players, as Miguel touched on. Can he do that? I think the jury's really, really out on that, because what they need to do, they've got a lot of quality young players. Can he develop them to be as good as they can be? And when you're talking about developing players, it's not just about developing 17, 18, 19 year olds. It's about helping those in their early or mid 20s to get better. That's sometimes something that's overlooked. I think because of we live in the era of Messi and Ronaldo, who should not be representative of anything apart from themselves. They're freaks. They're not like anyone else. We assume that if players haven't reached their footballing nirvana by the time they're 21, it's not happening, which is nonsense. And I think the fact that Isco, to go back to Isco, is a really good example. Zidane was getting the best out of him when you get to Real Madrid winning in Cardiff in 2017 against Juventus. He's possibly their best player in that Champions League campaign.
In fact, there was the big Bale-Isco debate around that period.
There was, wasn't there? But how he's not developed from there. And Zidane has got to take at least a little bit of the responsibility from that. And then you look at, you know, Marco Asensio. We know he's still got a lot of promise, but a lot of it is still promise.
But you see, if...
Is he the right coach to do that?
You see, what you've introduced is a dichotomy between running a club well, as you said, with Sevilla. With Sevilla, you said that they've got a chance because they're a well-run club. Now you're talking about a well-run team.
Yeah, that is different.
Yeah. It's a slightly different thing. And I wonder which is the more the greater imperative for this season.
I would say, actually, if there was any sort of... I can't believe I'm going to say this. If there was any sort of moral... morality play in football, Sevilla should win the title by virtue of just being better run than all the rest. Like, because in many ways they're actually an example to a lot of clubs.
Better run club.
Yeah, but the issue, of course, is that, I mean, the fact they're well run, it's all about finances.
The issue is that there's no morality in football.
Well, with that morality being connected to huge financial disparity, and the worry still is that no matter how well you run, and despite the problems the big two have, the big two just have such a force of number, which is basically bigger squads, now just enough quality that they'll still kind of push themselves.
Elite talent will out.
And there's almost a sense, and I really felt this last season actually, there was a sense of basically Madrid winning it by default. Yeah. I know they went on that incredible run, but they weren't, once again with that Madrid team under Zidane, they weren't exactly, you know... all that brilliant in that run.
It's not fantasy football by any stretch of the imagination.
It's not convincing. Yeah.
But to go back to your point, Dutton, the fact is, if you have a well-run club, it makes it so much easier to run the team well. Mm. Whereas now, if the club is in a situation where it can't spend any money, you need some sort of otherworldly effort from the coach, don't you?
Yeah.
To effectively use the resources that are at your disposal.
Op Mejuto González. Maar...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Join me, Melissa Reddy, and listen to my brand new podcast, Between the Lines. I'll be speaking to the biggest names in football about the captivating, behind-the-scenes stories fans want to hear. From major talking points to untold anecdotes, you'll hear from some of football's leading stars as well as those working in the shadows. In our first episode, I spoke to former Spurs manager Maurizio Pochettino about that Amazon documentary.
We feel responsible because it was very difficult to say yes to open the door to Amazon. Only we watch with Jesus the 25 minutes first, because it was until we left the club.
And on our latest episode, I investigate how prevalent and damaging social media abuse is in football.
And I was like taking all this negativity onto myself, and I did. I kind of lost myself and my personality because I knew everything that was going on around it. And it's not until I actually got to a stage where I thought, I can't take this anymore. It is becoming too much for me, that I spoke out about it.
Craving football insight? Well, look no further. Listen to Between the Lines with me, Melissa Reddy, via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
This was a Stakhanov production.
So let's talk about what's impending for a lot of nations this weekend, which is international games. And this is the Nations League games, isn't it, Andy? The Nations League, which has only started the other day.
Very much like when you go to a gig, Dotton, you've got to stand through a poor quality support act first.
That was in the old days, pre-COVID days.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what these international friendlies are. You know, you look at the teams that have been put out by some nations so far. Experimental, I guess, is the kind way of putting it. And you know, I'm not saying that Portugal versus Spain on Wednesday night didn't have its moments. Of course, they used it as a sort of occasion as well to announce their co-candidacy for the 2030 World Cup, which I think everyone in this room is certainly in favour of. That would be a pretty enjoyable tournament, yeah. But I think that, you know, there were some good moments in that. But these friendlies do seem like they're just a bit of a waste of time. And I think especially when you look at
the way Miguel sees it, by the way, and we'll come on to that in a moment.
Well, I think especially the health situation at the moment.
Yeah.
It feels, you can argue whether international football generally is tenable at the moment, and I think there's a big question over that. But these friendlies, on one hand, they're a massive inconvenience, and they're a health and safety minefield. On the other hand, you look at, and I said it on the ramble earlier, you look at how stacked the program is for the club season. When else do national coaches get to work with players?
Well, I think there's a few things there. First of all, even though these are massive inconveniences, and even though there is the huge, especially as cases rise around Europe or the world, the exact safety issue about playing these games, and really, like, if you look at the case of Ireland, say, they're in three different countries in the space of a week.
Do you want to declare an interest?
No, but you, just as an example, like, it's remarkable that they will be playing crossing three different borders. But, I mean, and the club game can complain all they want, or sorry, the major club game, but really, why these, there is an argument these are actually among the most important internationals we'll have, because the income is so necessary to run grassroots in the club game in so many countries, particularly outside the elite. So that is one reason they've pushed ahead. But, and also, from talking to someone in UEFA about a month ago, one of the reasons there's been an agreement to play these games is basically because UEFA and the federations bent over backwards for the clubs to move the Euros and allow the clubs to finish the club season. And I think that's a much bigger move than politically and logistically than people might have realised. I mean, even if it felt to many people that it was a no-brainer to move the Euros, that doesn't mean it was a no-brainer to actually execute. And I think that's why there's been a bit of horse trading about this. I think maybe a bigger issue in internationals, if you leave aside the very, very fair and pertinent questions over the logistics around these internationals in light of COVID, is I think the bigger issue of why exactly in a truncated season like this, truncated calendar, given how 2019-20 was pushed on, why is football so determined to get every single match played? I think that's where I think that's where there should have been more give.
Question.
A little bit more could have been done with European competition. Everyone's gone on about the League Cup in England. But I think there could have been a bit more give from that perspective, rather than kind of, immediately looking to the internationals as the one that's... But in saying all that, I think there is a very fair question about whether players should be crossing so many borders at this time.
And playing three matches.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a fair question, but the reality is that these, for what you call friendlies, Andy, is... Are much more important with the smaller footballing nations. Surely they're not just friendlies.
And you know what? Once you get past the friendlies, Dotton, so as you were saying, not just the Nations League games, but the Euro 2020 playoffs. I mean, these are absolutely huge matches. Yeah, aren't they?
And I for all the fixation it's going to be in friendlies tonight. Like I'm going to England Wales when what I would rather be doing is. Watching Ireland Slovakia,
hold on, we haven't got to game of the week yet.
I know. but I think, I mean, there's eight games tonight, and because they're essentially semi-finals, and they're not two-legged. I think there's going to be some brilliantly chaotic international football tonight. And the touchstone I always have as regards this is the last night of USA 94 qualifying. I think the date was November 13th, when there was basically mayhem all over Europe. I think these eight games could be similar because because just it's just a one-off game to get another playoff to get to the Euros. So there's so much on that and from an emotional perspective. And B, because of the how important it's going to be to federations to qualify for the Euros as well.
Yeah.
So there could be a 7-2.
Like financially.
It could be a 7-2 or a 6-1.
I think there's going to be some exceptional games.
I quite like the look of Norway. I mean, they're the team who are thinking ahead of their game against Serbia.
Yeah.
Right. Well, stuff you guys. We really want this to happen because I think you look at what's happened to them over the last year with Haaland, with Sorloth, even coming to the fore in Turkey before he moved to Leipzig. When you look at Odegaard, they're in a position, if I was a Serbia player, and I'm not going to stereotype them as a team of old men, you might be holding the small of your back and going, oh, I don't really fancy chasing them around
they've got engines under the Norwegian.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. But I think it's quite interesting to look at the teams that we perceive as the favourites as well. And obviously it's so hard to judge France off the back of their friendly against Ukraine because... You know, obviously, eight Ukrainians pulled out because of a COVID spread, to the extent where their goalkeeper on the bench was 45-year-old Alexander Shavkovsky, who's the goalkeeping coach.
Earlier on, you said don't dismiss players just when they get to a certain age if they're not 21.
But if they don't play anymore, Dotton.
Yeah, goalkeepers are different species.
Also, I have absolutely no sympathy for Shavkovsky because once I remember I was covering a game out in Braga, between Braga and Dinamo Kiev, who's Shavkovsky's most famous for playing for. And I remember speaking to a couple of the Ukrainian journalists, because Dinamo were very different to Shakhtar in that Shakhtar had loads of Brazilians. Of course, I could talk to them, no problem. I didn't speak, still don't speak any Ukrainian. So I spoke to one of the travelling Ukrainian journalists and go, is there any players who speak, English or something that's not Ukrainian? And this guy goes to me, oh, Shavkovsky, he speaks excellent English. Grab him. And so I leant over in the mix zone when the players come out of the changing room to speak to him. And I said, Alexander, have you got a minute? And he goes, I'm terribly sorry. I'm afraid my standard of English is very poor and I won't be able to help you. In this like Mansfield Park voice. Yeah. I'm like, that is outrageous. Yeah. But fair play to him. He did me up like a kipper. Yeah. I think you look at France and, they're endlessly exciting. Yeah. Maybe not under Didier Deschamps as a coach. Maybe that's the touch.
This is a bit of a tangent, but... especially given the level we're talking about. But I must say, given the fact that in terms of application and I suppose quality of football and time they have, the club game is about 15 years behind, sorry, the international game is about 15 years behind the club game. There is actually an argument that the best practice for international football is now a solid base and go from there, especially exactly. especially at the very top level, which is basically...
After you play 60 games in a season, how else are you going to play? Yeah. Again, it was something we touched upon on the ramble earlier. I think it's something that plays against England, the fact that they want to play in a Premier League way when it gets the game. You know, you're going to be knackered after like 65 minutes. Whereas if you just sit and play this more reactive style. I mean, Deschamps is always going to be criticised for this because of the sort of players he has. People want to see those players play. But in fact, the heart of that France team that wins the World Cup, it's not Pogba. It's Griezmann and it's Luca Hernandez. The players who... Well, they're Atletico players and they played like Atletico for a lot of that World Cup.
And the other side of it, I think maybe... the sequence of domination by Spain and Germany maybe tricked us a little bit in terms of international football because, you know, it looked like, okay, as with the club game, that kind of, you know, possession pressing approach is now, this is the optimum, this is how you play. Mm. This is the optimum level of football. But the difference with Spain and Germany is they were basically based on two club sides, which gave them a cohesion that no other international side can match.
And can I ask you, actually, while we're on that then, Miguel, do you think Spain and Germany are genuine contenders going into Euro 2020? Because Spain, I could still be convinced, I think, and they play very well at the start of this friendly with Portugal. I thought they were terrific in the first half. But Germany, again, and you know, it's hard to make hard and fast judgments about a series of friendlies when we're in the situation that we're in and we have some absent players, etc., etc. But Germany, again, making tons of defensive mistakes against Turkey. And I think, you know, it's not about playing well, is it? It's about getting the results in the tournament. I don't think Germany are anywhere near favourites for this tournament.
Well, I think that opens up a very interesting debate, actually, because I think... If you stand back and particularly look at kind of European football at the club game of the past few years, and even the championship actually, Germanic pressing has become the most cutting edge element of modern football. It basically runs the game now. But that pressing is based on the type of intensity and the type of cohesion and integration that's only possible at club level because the amount of time they have and how drilled they are, Liverpool being the classic examples. So then you have all these, Germany have basically produced a generation of players capable of this. And I think suddenly, after a little bit of a lean spell, Germany has a lot of players coming through that are really exciting from that regard. But then they go into an international team where they can't develop the same cohesion together, especially when now they're all at different club sides all over Europe.
Yeah.
So suddenly, what they're best suited for and what the country has done so well to develop may not necessarily suit the national team to the optimum degree. And it's why I think you see so many defensive errors. Because it's basically like a Klopp team done badly in the sense that, you know, when a Klopp team drops off from their top level, suddenly they become prone to loads of mistakes because it's just, they're so intense. But it will naturally leave holes, but it's a calculated risk. Whereas when they're not quite on it, it would just leave more holes. I think that's almost, that's why we see Germany as they are. And I do just, when it comes right down to it in a tournament like that, I think Spain could be brilliant, but I think they're too light in contrast to France. And Germany, as it stands, are a bit too ragged. Now, of course, I mean, the thing about international football is, you know, It's only really what 5-6 games to the Euro, so he's going to wear in a club game. That's nothing.
Yeah.
But in international football, it's almost a year, and so much can change over that time.
You see, you shouldn't dismiss international games as friendlies in the way that you did, Andy Brassel. They're much more profound than that, as Miguel has so eloquently explained, yeah? They have ramifications.
I think the fact that you're sitting in Marcus Speller's seat has had an effect on you.
Janine here. Donadoni. Och bra skott. Och retur. Och Chiracchi och mål. Nu slår han till igen. Den är fantastiske. Sicilianare.
We should also talk about what's going on in Italy. We know Juve's issues and the problems, and they're up against Napoli. What should we make of what's going on there, Miguel?
I think this is one of the most interesting stories in Europe because it's going to be indicative of how... I think there's going to be a lot of similar examples of this.
Well, of course, we should clarify first that this was the big match last Sunday, meant to happen. Napoli told by their local health authority that they can't travel and they have to quarantine at their training ground. Juventus saying that's not how we read the rules, and having this totally bizarre pantomime where they prepare for the match, pretend that it's happening, their Twitter account tweets out the formation and the 11. They turn up to the stadium. These are pictures of our boys turning up at the stadium. Everyone's in the stand and on the television feed.
Look
for
behind
it.
You. Somebody was shouting that.
Exactly. Okay. Because on the television feed, it had Juventus versus Napoli, awaiting arrival of away team. it's total like waiting for Godot.
Like it.
It's just not happening.
That is just basically just a case. Juventus want to kind of fulfill their interpretation of the rules to the letter of the law so they don't leave themselves open, isn't it?
So they get their 3-0 win.
Yeah,
that's right. Now, interestingly, because they disagree so fundamentally over the interpretation of the rule and where the regional authorities' rule ties in with the national plan, because like the
it's
league
like an insurance company, yeah, will we have to pay out or not?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it, because the league have said, well, you only had two players testing positive for COVID, therefore by the rules you should be able to play on. And obviously Juventus saying, well, our local health authority said what your local health authority said doesn't make any difference, you're at the other end of the country. And so yeah, then you were this situation where it looked like, well, the Juventus were obviously pushing for the 3-0 win, the walkover. Now it's moved along a little bit where the game looks like it will be played, but there's been the suggestion in various sections of the Italian media that Napoli might be docked a point for not coming. When, as far as they're concerned, they weren't allowed to come. Now, some have suggested...
It's going to end up in court, this one.
Oh, it definitely will. But some have suggested that Aurelio De Laurentiis, the president of Napoli, gave a call to the local health authorities saying, what are you saying? We can't go. Which is a lot different to the local authority saying to local... health authority saying, you can't go.
Okay, we've obviously missed something along the way here. We understand why Juventus want the 3 points.
Yes.
Why did Napoli not want to face Juventus, and particularly at this time?
Well, I think because of, you know, you look at the players who were ruled out from going. It was Elif Elmas and Piotr Zielinski, players who are good players, but they could do without. I don't think they necessarily affect the result. And the sense was, because Napoli had played Genoa the previous weekend, now Genoa had two cases who weren't able to play. They end up going to Napoli. They lose 6-0. And what, 2 days later, comes out that 16 people at Genoa have got it. Now, I think you have to bear that in mind. I think that's something. Just because they got tested and came back with a negative, I think they're looking at the Genoa situation and thinking that could be us, and that's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's why this is. I mean, while the actual specific Juventus Napoli case has so many strands, which makes it so compelling, but I think the wider story is it could be a bit of a case study for Europe, because I think we're going to have this. Now, obviously, kind of the local authorities, you know, there are different protocols to it all around the continent, but the fundamental of it, which is, I suppose, like inevitably, some clubs are going to face a lot of cases, which has a knock-on effect. And I think it's going to throw... And this is why the earlier point about such a stacked calendar, I think, is all the more important, because we're inevitably going to have a situation where there are postponements, which puts a real strain in the football calendar. I don't think we're going to get to the point again where football is cancelled or postponed, because I think they've proven... They have a base idea to get round the main problem, and if protocols are followed, the game can be played. But I think we are going to see more postponements, and I think it's going to cause some political issues with the calendar, and maybe, and a lot of headaches, maybe federations and clubs.
Well, that's it, Miguel. The thing is, the answer to it is quite obvious, and the answer is something we should have learnt from the original hiatus going back to March. The fact is that football authorities get in an enormous panic when there's the potential of a postponement because there is simply no room in the calendar.
Yeah.
What we should have learned from that as a football community is there is simply too much football. The way it has been approached by the football authorities all over Europe since is, right, we've got to ram in everything.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Which is...
But do you not feel this with this whole situation in general? It's basically been... I mean, as terrible as it's been, for football, it did actually offer the opportunity to have a rethink. Now, while I do accept that the major pressure early on was just to work out a way to get football back, it does feel like a lot of potential lessons have already been squandered.
Yes.
And that it's all been, again, a bit on the hoof rather than, and trying to adjust things rather than taking the opportunity to look at, you know, where we can address bigger issues in the game.
And I do wonder if what holds football generally back from dealing with that is the tribal nature of this.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think the Juventus-Napoli discussion is a very good case in point, for example. In a common sense situation, they just say, right, we're in the time that we are, and Juventus go, yeah, let's play it another day.
Yeah.
But they decide to double down and go...
Because they've got other issues, haven't they? And, they've got other issues.
And the league decide to double down as well on it, which is something I find very disappointing. I think the league have to be stronger here.
Well, and again, I remember in March, April, the constant message was from like the top levels of UEFA and top levels of the game was, well, one of the positives is it's actually brought the game together. And one of the examples given was how Infantino was willing to park his big, grand and massively problematic idea of a Club World Cup for a year to give the game space. Whereas it didn't take too long for suddenly all this spirit of cohesion to, as you say, kind of collapse into a lot of old battlegrounds.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to a certain extent, though. I'm not surprised because football has consequences. Same. Football has consequences on both ends, you know. So if you postpone a game, like you've said, has a knock-on effect. But also, if you reduce the number of games, there'll be teams, not least on the lower end, who think, well, hang on, we would have won that tournament if you hadn't cancelled it.
Yeah.
It's got consequences. The ball is round. Finally, guys, the moment that we all look forward to is hearing about your games of the week. Now, you will have come up with the thought of a great game that we can all watch and for free, most importantly. So don't take it down that cable route, please.
If only it was possible to do it for free.
It's a bit difficult this week.
I'm going to go for Sunday night, 7:45, France versus Portugal. Hopefully, if everything goes well, it's a Nations League game that will be a rehearsal for the group game in Euro 2020. So we'll cross our fingers for that, which will be played in Budapest, I believe. But anyway, this one's going to be in Paris. We talked about France and the depth they've got. It's also very interesting, and they won't play against Portugal, I don't think, but the team that played against Ukraine contained Usama Aouar, who, of course, still belongs to Lyon, and Eduardo Camavinga, who still belongs to Rennes. Aouar was excellent. Camavinga got that opening goal with just an amazing over-the-shoulder finish, and his attacking part of his game is something he's only developing at the moment. So, I don't know, part of me wonders whether these impertinent upstarts are joining the team and thinking, you want us to play defensively? We ain't having that, DD. I don't know if that's the case, but the fact that there's more exciting attacking talent available or just talent generally available to France is a real positive. We've seen Deo Upamecano play the last couple of games as well. And then on Portugal's side, I mean, they were dreadful for the first half against Spain, much better after the break. And then you look at all those attacking options. Clearly Cristiano Ronaldo's chasing Ali Daei's record. He's not giving up any minutes anytime soon.
Arrange a friendly against Andorra.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll tell you what, ask England under 21s. It's no walk in the park anymore.
Yeah.
But I think you look at the talent there, and that's what's interesting. When you contrast and compare Portugal and France, the fact that Didier Deschamps, it doesn't matter the amount of talent, they're going to play a certain way. Whereas with Portugal, who very much played a certain way to win Euro 2016 under Fernando Santos, people thought he couldn't be that guy that, say, Zidane needs to be in integrating more exciting young players. Yeah. He's actually done that very, very well.
I remember thinking, I was at that Euro 2016 final. I remember thinking, like, again, this is a bit Greece, like, this is a dull Portuguese team to win. But again, it comes back to the point that if you want to succeed in international football, it looks like this may be the model now. It's quite old fashioned, but in a term of keep it tight, work your way through, and then rely on a bit of individual inspiration at the other end.
A bit of Ed Air magic.
Yeah.
I think you've already given away to a certain extent what your game of the week is going to be, Miguel, but surprise us.
Well, I would genuinely pick any of the eight playoff semi-finals tonight, because I think that these are games that really mean something, basically. And that significance, I think, is going to bring out a lot of very entertaining football, if very painful football for some, for those that miss out. In terms of the most glamorous fixture, you'd probably go with Norway-Serbia, given there's so much young talent in that Norway side, particularly Haaland. But I suppose I'm going to let I'm going to let a little bit of bias come into it. I'm going to go for Slovakia-Ireland. As you can tell from the accent. But
you're Slovakian.
Slovakia have actually had... I mean, there's an interesting build-up to this in the sense that Ireland are a country now. Obviously, there's been a certain perception of Irish football for 20 years, or 30 years, really, going back to someone who we've talked about so much over the past few months, Jack Charlton. And Stephen Kenny has come in there, and he's basically... I mean... You could say he's a Southgate figure in the sense that he's come through it's very continental model of international management, in that it's someone who's just taken on the senior job from one of the underage jobs under 21, where he did very well. He has had success in Irish football, even though there's been a debate in Ireland about how much that matters when you're kind of dealing with potentially a lot of Premier League players. But also one of his main concerns has been essentially transforming the identity of Irish football and trying to instill what would be a modern, expansive approach. But of course, that takes a lot more than two games, which is all that he's had so far. Two Nations League games where they got one goal and it was a classic Shane Duffy header. And suddenly he's prematurely been thrust into a situation where he has this playoff against Slovakia that is actually hugely important to Irish football in terms of the finances, not least because... four of the games are in Dublin in Euro 2020, which is such a massive opportunity. But of course, Kenny wasn't meant to be in charge of this game at all. It was meant to be Mick McCarthy, but that was COVID complicated that, because McCarthy's contract initially ran to what was supposed to be the end of the Euro 2020 campaign, but that ended up being a date and time rather than an actual campaign. So the big question is whether Ireland are ready, or how compromised maybe Kenny's football has to be. I mean, he's more pragmatic than often made out, but they've been handed an opportunity, like a Slovakia team that is probably at the moment in a better place than Ireland, just about, but they've had a huge loss now, and they've lost Skriniar to COVID. So I think it's one of many usually compelling games tonight.
Gentlemen, thank you.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.